welcome to the Mariners Library with me, Chris Stanmore Major. Now, in this episode, we're beginning a new book. It's called In Broken Water by Adlard Coles, and it was published first in 1925. Now, Adlard Coles is a name that you probably know. He founded the Adlard Coles Publishing Company, and they now have over 300 books in print. Many of your favourite sailing tomes, no doubt, are published by Adlard Coles. So I'll read you the inside of the jacket here, and we can get a feel for what's coming up. In Broken Water by Adlard Coles. In this book, the author describes his first long cruise, which was made from Southampton, up the English Channel, across the North Sea to Holland, and thence through the Dutch canals and the Zuider Zee to the Frisian Islands. The cruise continued by way of the River Elbe and the Kiel Canal to the Baltic, with the return passage in bad weather against the prevailing winds. The yacht Annette, in which the voyage was made, was a gaff-rigged sloop of under 20 feet in waterline length with no auxiliary engine. Her design was of extreme type, combining great beam with shoal draft, and she was one of the first semi-racing yachts to be used for long-distance sailing. The cruise was made along interesting coasts and was eventful, especially in the navigation among the sands surrounding the Frisian Islands, and in Germany at the time of the crash of the Mark and the political troubles which led to the rise of Hitler. The first four reviews. Incident, excitement and adventure, vividly described and with a fine sense of humour, breezy and very amusing. A first book so entertaining that the author will do well to find material in further cruises, that others may follow it. That from the Westminster Gazette. Delightful, says the Devon Gazette. A very readable record of a happy adventure. There is the salt of the sea in every chapter. Should be read with genuine delight by all who love the sea. That from the Southern Daily Echo. And a daring voyage. The book is marked by freshness and vivacity with the sound of the sea all through it. From the Aberdeen Press and Journal. There we go. So if any of that appeals, we're going to get into it next. If you haven't already, please consider going over to Patreon. And for $5 a month, your donation to the podcast keeps all the wheels going. And we can keep bringing this knowledge to new generations and keep these wonderful stories and the knowledge contained therein protected for many years to come. Now on with the story. To my grandmother, who encouraged these things. Preface to the first edition. This book contains an account of a cruise from Burlesdon near Southampton to Copenhagen and back in a small yacht. The writer had lately arrived at the age when he ceased to be an infant in the eyes of the law and had arrived at what are accurately known as years of discretion. The reader is asked to imagine himself putting to sea in a boat measuring under 20 feet in waterline length and cruising abroad, gathering knowledge both of the sea and of the world as he sails along. The year 1923, in which the passage was made, was marked by summer gales and by the final collapse of the Mark in Germany, a country then on the verge of revolution. During the cruise, mistakes due to inexperience were made, and for the same reason, mistakes have doubtless been made in the writing of this book, but it is hoped that what has been wanting in seamanship and penmanship will be compensated by freshness, for the cruise was a first cruise, and this book, a first book. The opportunity must be taken to thank those older sailing men who gave the writer the benefit of their experience. Mr. Francis B. Cook for writing his helpful book, Single-Handed Cruising, and to thank in particular the amateur crew Buster and Dunsterville, who shared all the discomforts and few of the compensations. Keynes, Adlard Coles, 1924. A quick insert from me. My first trip sailing on a boat where I was the captain was a 40-foot yacht going from Southampton to Copenhagen between regattas back in 2008. And so I look forward with anticipation, as you do, to finding out how it went for Adlard Coles. Now, I see there is a preface to the second edition, which was printed in 1956. It's quite lengthy. There's lots of information in it. So I think let's come back to that at the end. And let's begin the voyage with Adlard Coles in Broken Waters right away. Chapter 1. Annette. Annette was a gaff-rigged 6.5-ton TM sloop built at Le Havre in 1920 by Chantiers et Forges de Le Havre. The hull design was unusual, for on an overall length of 26 foot 6 inches, she had a spoon bow and a counter stern, which reduced her waterline length to 19 feet, which was combined with the exceptional beam of 9 feet 2 inches. That is to say, her maximum beam was nearly half her waterline length. The draft was only 4 feet, and the short iron keel weighed 30 hundredweight. She was designed as a racing rather than a cruising yacht, and carried a big spread of canvas in her high-peaked mainsail and the staysail, which set to a short bowsprit. Both had roller reefing gear. The yacht's accommodation consisted of a small cabin, with a wide berth on each side and a central table. In the forecastle there was a cot to starboard, and a large cupboard and storage for spare warps and gear on the port side. She had no auxiliary engine, and no WC, other than a bucket. The headroom under the coach roof aft was about 5 foot 9 inches, and considerably less forward. The layout was simple, and the accommodation somewhat Spartan, but she was a nice-looking boat, in new condition, and large compared with my former boats. Annette came into the market during my last term at Cambridge, during 1923, and I bought her immediately, as she would afford the opportunity to make a good cruise during the long vacation before putting my nose to an office desk. At that time, she was named Annie II, but everybody told me she would never get beyond the English Channel with a name like that, and if I courted bad luck by changing the name, I should never get beyond the Solent. In a bright moment, I hit on Annette, a compromise which changed the name without unduly courting bad luck. Having the prospect of 4 months free and a good little ship, I regret to say that much of my last term was spent in planning and preparing for a long cruise. I had many ideas which started cautiously in the first early mornings when training for rowing dragged me early from bed, and which grew more ambitious as the day passed, reaching their maximum in the evenings after a pint of strong ale in hall. Finally, I settled on the North Sea and the Baltic with Copenhagen as the target. My imagination had been fired by reading Erskine Childers' The Riddle of the Sands. There was an attraction in the windswept wastes of the Frisian Islands, in the shallow waterways through the sands, and in the bleak German coast, where the three rivers, Jade, Wasser and Elbe, meet the monotonous North Sea. Strange names like Mehmet, Juist and Langhorn, Nordene Gat and Akumer E, fascinated me, and I wanted to see the places and waters for myself. E.F. Knight's The Falcon on the Baltic added to my interest and extended it to the limpid fjords of the Baltic, though I fancy the appeal of those sheltered waters was secondary to the more primitive urge towards the forlornness of the little-known German seaboard. As my cruising had been confined to the Solent, Chichester Harbour and Poole, the proposed cruise was to be my first serious voyage into waters as unknown to me as the South Seas. An immense amount of preparation had to be made. Charts of the North and Baltic Seas were obtained. There were blue backs published by Imre, Laurie, Norrie and Wilson, and I glued them down on thick sheets of cardboard and varnished the fronts so that they could be used on deck regardless of the weather. Many happy hours were spent poring over these charts. Pilot and navigation books did not provide very much help in planning, as they were concerned with the problems of big steamers, rather than with the channels and small harbours suitable for impertinent little fry, such as Annette. From experienced yachtsmen I obtained considerable encouragement and discouragement, for some were decidedly pessimistic about the venture. However, the pluses were greater than the minuses, and I received much useful advice from members of the Royal Cruising Club, whose yachts were based on Burlesdon, and from the Cruising Association of which I was a member. In fact, the CA Handbook was my Bible on general seamanship. The principal question was getting to Holland in a yacht which was not generally regarded as seaworthy. I could cross from Dover to France and then follow the coast, which would be a slow way and would involve crossing the treacherous mouths of the Schelder, or I could make a direct crossing from Jever to IJmuiden in Holland, taking the risk of the 140-mile passage at one go. I had read a lot about gales in the standard cruising books written by Claude Worth and Francis B. Cook, and in theory knew all about heaving to and sea anchors. I decided in favour of the direct passage. Annette herself required modifications for extended cruising, and many additions to her inventory. The yacht at that time was in no way suited for long-distance sailing. She carried a tremendous sail area, and while her spoon bow, handsome counter and short keel were typical of a racing boat, they were much frowned upon by my cruising friends. The big open cockpit, which was not self-emptying, might prove a weak feature in a following sea. Theoretically, she was no boat for heavy weather, but personally, I felt sure she was well capable of holding her own, and I had much confidence in her excessive beam. I did my best to make her more suitable for rough sailing. I had 2 feet cut off the gaff and off the boom, which reduced the area to workable proportions, and Messrs. G.S. Tilling & Sons of Southampton made a splendid suit of new sails of strong flax, lightly tanned, and also provided a fine sea anchor, which was never used, and a storm jib and an almost new trysail, which were. The question of the big open cockpit was left to the discretion of Mr. Alfred and Mr. Herbert Moody of the well-known yacht yard at Burlston near Southampton. They decided to deck it in fully with a curved deck extending from the combings as far forward as the cabin hatch, leaving only a small well in the centre in which the helmsman could put his feet. An oblong canvas bucket with a wooden rim at the top was made to fit exactly into the well, the idea being that if it were filled by a wave, the bucket could be emptied over the side. Moody's did the job, and other alterations very competently, and when I saw Annette, she was completely decked in and virtually unsinkable. Entrance could only be effected by lowering oneself down a small hatch into the cabin or by means of the forehatch. This effectively prevented persons of ample proportions from coming below at all, and led to amusing scenes in Holland where genial visitors stuck halfway, with their legs waving madly about in the cabin and arms in midair violently gesticulating for assistance. Choice of crew was an important matter, and here I was lucky as 2 other undergraduates, L.W. Dunsterville and Buster, volunteered to join Annette for the cruise. Dunsterville and I had been at school together, but Buster had served in the war before going up to Cambridge. Dunsterville had not done much sailing before, and Buster none at all, so it was a matter of an inexperienced crew sailing with an inexperienced skipper. However, we were very keen. Chapter 2. Burlston to the Hook. On June the 13th, Annette lay off Moody's Yard at Burlston. I had run down the day before and had spent an intensely active time getting gear on board and stowing it away. Incidentally, the stowing away took the longest time, and I tried to cut short my shore visits as much as possible, as I imagined that I could see a grin on each face. Burlston had witnessed my early education in sailing. Burlston had seen Jessica ashore and had seen Lapwing with her jib badly set. Burlston had taught me what a shackle was and told me not to tie a granny, so Burlston was very sceptical as to my capacity for skippering a ship at sea. On the next day, Dunsterville arrived, and the following morning we bade farewell to our friends ashore, who, after all, had been much more helpful than critical. We beat down the river on the last of the ebb, which carried us down to Hamble Spit, and presently the young flood gave us a fair tide up Southampton water. We spent 3 days at Southampton, anchored off the Royal Pier. Messrs. Tilling arranged for the compass to be swung, an operation which took place off Hythe, and although no error was expected since the yacht had no engine or iron in the vicinity of the compass, it was comforting to have it confirmed that there was no deviation. We worked on a 360-degree card, degrees being easier to my mathematical mind than points, which needed memorising. We also provisioned for the voyage at Southampton. We took a large quantity of tinned meats, soups and beans, as we were doubtful as to the quality of stores of this sort bought abroad. We also shipped a 7-pound tin of ship's biscuits and plenty of marmalade. These precautions proved wise, as we found marmalade almost unprocurable abroad, and we experienced difficulty in obtaining tinned foods of good quality, except at big ports. Actually, we only had to do major provisioning again at Kiel and Copenhagen, where the prices were a little lower and the quality poor, as there was no difficulty in obtaining fresh provisions such as eggs, milk, cheese, meat, fruit and vegetables in any of the towns and villages we visited. When Buster joined us, our crew was complete, and on Saturday we had a farewell dinner with Mr. H.L.P. Jolly, from whom I had bought Annette, and some friends who were also shortly going to go to the Baltic to commission Jolly's new yacht and to sail her home. We planned to foregather again at Kiel. Sunday was spent with our anchor mixed up with those of a 150-ton yacht just back from the Mediterranean. It was bad luck, as it took all her crew some hours' work in the sun to get us free. We rejoiced greatly. We were not to blame, as it was she that had given us the foul berth. The weather had been vile, rain and wind, Sunday excepted, but on Monday, June the 18th, we were ready for sea. At 4:15 p.m, we hove up the anchor, set sail, and our voyage started. It was a great moment, and with a nice westerly breeze, a net reached fast down Southampton Water and altered course to the southeast. She passed Ryde and Portsmouth, but after slipping between the forts into the open sea, the wind began to drop, and at nightfall, the yacht was becalmed near the Nab Tower. We let go anchor, and for a while watched rockets and firing, which showed that some naval night stunt was in progress. Although the wind had dropped, a considerable swell was still running, so when we turned in, our efforts to get some sleep were by no means successful. At 1:45 a.m, there was a light air from the south-southwest, and we were only too pleased to leave our berths, and with a squeaking of blocks and cursing at the refractory anchor chain, Annette was got underway again. From the Nab, we had to stand out seawards to clear the shoals off Selsey Bill. It was a dark night, and the wind freshened steadily. At dawn, we were far out of sight of land, and after the general excitement of final preparations and the disturbed night, we felt anything but bright and decidedly hungry. At 5:30 a.m, we passed the Oa's lightship, and some hours later, as wind and sea were rising and the barometer falling, we stood in to pick up the coast. Just before 11 a.m, the yacht was off Newhaven, with two turns in the reefing gear, which were inadequate, so we altered course to enter the harbour. The moment Annette was in the shelter of the piers, pandemonium broke loose. First we were hailed by the coast guard at the entrance to the harbour, and then by various officials all the way up. When we came to berth number 9, we received instructions not only from the harbour master, but also from a customs officer, two fishermen and a yachtsman. We took the advice of the latter and were soon tied up in our right position. We were tired after our sailing and very hungry, so we particularly welcomed the invitation to lunch on our neighbouring yachtsman's Lucette, after which we turned in to rest and to think over the activities of our first 20 hours at sea. I was a little worried, as our handling of Annette had been none too seamanlike. Now that Annette's cockpit had been cut down in size, there was little room on deck left for the crew. Buster was somewhat handicapped by a wound in the leg received during the war, and Annette had no stanchions or anything to get a hold on. Accordingly, we arranged that Dunstable and I should do most of the deck work, and Buster volunteered to do the cooking, while the steering watches were divided equally between the three of us. In a small boat, the cooking is the great difficulty. It is easy to stay on deck in bad weather to face the music, but the unfortunate cook has to remain below, where the yacht's motion is infinitely more noticeable, in order to persuade an evil-smelling stove to boil the greasy fat with which to fry food for the happy mariners in the fresh air above. Few men are sufficiently immune from seasickness to cook in a seaway, so Buster's offer was a great help, and many times we blessed him after a wet and tiring watch when we had a hot meal awaiting us. Next day, we started with a fair tide for Dover, but there was a strong northeasterly headwind and rough going between Beachy Head and Dungeness. A small accident occurred when one of the crew tried to put the yacht about in the heavy sea and got in irons. The boom banged wildly about and the boom end fitting, carrying the topping lift and the sheet, parted. The end of the boom was 3 feet outside the counter, and as the yacht was plunging violently, it took me an hour to effect temporary repairs. We ran back for Newhaven, making very fast progress at first, but in the afternoon the wind fell and we did not get to Newhaven until 10 o'clock at night, and then only through Dunstable sweating at the sculls in the dinghy to tow Annette in a flat calm. The next day we had a nice northwesterly breeze. We got underway at 8 a.m, passed the Royal Sovereign lightship at 10:30 a.m, Dungeness at 3:45 p.m, but were becalmed off Folkestone. Eventually we picked up a fresh breeze, which took the yacht into Dover Harbour, where we anchored off the shore shortly after 8 p.m. The following 2 days, it blew hard from the west, but we were quite busy with final provisioning, getting ready for departure from England, and with amusements of more frivolous character. We carried a large water tank under the old cockpit floor, which from time to time we filled with a petrol can. We had two of these yellow petrol tins, one with lettering on it for water, and the other for paraffin. Dunsterville, who had not been told of the significance of the cans, mixed them up and put 2 gallons of paraffin into the water tank. It did not taste at all nice, and it was a long time before all traces of paraffin were removed. This misadventure was not allowed to detract from our stay at Dover, but there is always a degree of frustration in being confined to a harbour instead of sailing, and so we were delighted when fair weather came on Saturday, a fine, warm day with a nice westerly breeze. In the morning, we breakfasted at the Lord Warden Hotel, and afterwards sent a wire to the meteorological office for a weather report. The answer arrived at 3 o'clock. Moderate northwest wind, mainly fine, but mist locally. We proposed to sail direct across the North Sea from Dover to Eimhouden, a distance of about 140 miles. Navigation would be helped by checking our position with the Sandetti, the North Hinder, and the Mars lightships, which were strung out at intervals on our course. It was not until 8 p.m. that we set sail, and Annette glided out between the piers of the east entrance of Dover, with boom squared out to the light westerly breeze. We were soon at the South Goodwin, and with the tide under us made the East Goodwin lightship just before 10 o'clock. When the distant lights on the French coast, Cape Grisnez, Calais and Dunkirk were sighted, and the yacht's navigation lights were lit, Annette seemed to us a real little ship as she sailed fast through the night. The traffic up and down the channel was very thick after the Goodwins, and we were never without the lights of at least 3 steamers in sight. One of 2 of these well-lit monsters came so close as to cause us much anxiety. Suppose they came a little nearer and failed to notice our little packet, what then? So whenever a steamer approached within 20 yards, we showed a white light. This occurred 3 times, and each time the steamer stopped her engines, apparently to offer assistance. Our side lights were of good size and should have been sufficient, but when a great ship seems to be rushing on top of one, there is a strong urge to make one's presence known. Author's note, 1956. 20 yards seems extraordinarily close. At night, what appears to be only a few yards away may in reality be much more. After passing the Sandetti lightship and setting a course for the North Hinder, we took watch by watch, changing every 2 hours. Out there, halfway between England and France, we began to feel somewhat lonely, and our yacht very small. We were far out at sea, where, if by some sudden whim of the weather a gale should occur, we should have to take what came, if necessary, by lying to a sea anchor or running for uncertain shelter. Other ships glided by, intent on their grave business, steering their courses with deliberate certainty. We, too, were finding our way from point to point deliberately, but the trouble was that we had not the same confidence. 12 hours' sail to the northeast lay the North Hinder lightship, and if we failed to pick this up, we should miss one of the most useful of the intermediate signposts of our ocean road. To us, as yet unfamiliar with offshore cruising, that would be a serious matter, for to the east lay the series of Dutch islands with extensive off-lying sands and complicated tides, and ahead lay the strange, featureless coast of Holland. I had not cruised foreign before, and I wondered how we would find or identify Eimhouden. Small wonder that after 9 hours sailing, we cast anxious eyes over the horizon for the lightship. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next installment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound. And I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.